Due to data limitations, today's special 2-hour episode has been broken into two separate segments. This is 87 Bravo, the second segment. If this is the first podcast you are listening to, please listen to 87 Alpha, the previous podcast in your iTunes playlist.
Hello, and welcome to the seventh podcast of the PTT and SimSec Falklands series. This is an amphibious command panel. This panel is made up of Michael Clapp, the amphibious task group commander, Julian Thompson, the commander 3rd Brigade, and Jeremy Larkin, the flag captain and captain of HMS Fearless. It is a conversation I have wanted to have since I first started studying the Falklands War from an academic perspective. They are amazing men to work with. I have had the pleasure of knowing them since I did my bachelor's, and I hope that you enjoy listening to this podcast as much as I enjoyed recording to it, and that you find this podcast and the words of these very wise men as beneficial and as thought-provoking as I have. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy.
Just like the Office of Personnel Management gives away everybody's greatest secrets, SimSec and our Sea Control podcast are here to give you the greatest content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Of course, we couldn't do this without you. The podcast listeners, article readers, content contributors, conference attendees, and voluntary leaders. Sea Control isn't just a podcast, and SimSec isn't just a website. We are a labor of love by a dedicated community. China already has all of your personal information, so you may as well share a little bit with us. Consider signing up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Receive emails with our latest articles and events. Gain access to your own SimSec WordPress account, which will allow you to share articles with our editorial staff and your insight with a broader community. And remember, subscribe, like, and give 5-star rating to us on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. We would still do this podcast even if you thought it was a horrible dumpster fire. But the nice reviews do make us feel a little bit better about ourselves.
Right then. Left Ascension, on way south, final planning. There is one question I'm going to ask. Well, there's actually two. There's one which is slightly less serious and one which is more serious. In Ewan Sotheby Taylor's book, he says he made drastic sort of defenses to try and prevent there being any landing on a particular beach because it had a large number of penguins. My main question is, did you manage to keep a straight face when he was making these presentations to keep you away from the penguins? Or was it done in a more serious attitude?
It wasn't drawn to my attention. I think it's Ewan possibly having a little bit of license. He came to me about that particular beach and told me there was likelihood of surf. And that was enough for me. I went off it very quickly because the operation was going to have to be fast. We were going to have to keep our fingers crossed that we had achieved surprise, and the offload would have to be as fast as we could go because we were very badly defended. We had very few Sea Harriers who had to provide combat air patrols for the aircraft carriers 200 miles out and also for ourselves. So it wasn't a 24-hour air cover and so on, and I was very well aware of that. I was also very well aware that there were some Argentine submarines, which we weren't too sure of their capabilities or where they were. And so sitting off that particular piece of coast might have made us rather a good target, and so on. So I rather jumped at his idea of surf and then started searching for a more landlocked place, which would be flat water. And I think to start with, Julian will say whether he was happy with that, but I think initially it probably meant quite a huge upheaval for Julian, because the only place we could find was St. Carlos Water. San Salvador Inlet was too shallow for most of the ships to get in, and we would have had to have launched from out at sea. So the ships would have been possibly in a swell, even though the actual beaches would have been calm and San Salvador Water would have been calm. So that wasn't awfully clever. And hence we chose St. Carlos, and thankfully Julian was prepared to come along with it and accept that he was 40 to 60 miles further away than he would have liked, and so on. But it actually worked out very well as far as the overall operation was concerned.
I never liked those beaches anyway, Volunteer Bay, because to get to Stanley, you had to go through a very narrow isthmus, which joins that blob of the Falkland Islands to the next blob down, which would have been a choke point. And furthermore, being a Royal Marine, I understood the problems of surf. I might not have understood it if I'd been in the 5th Infantry Brigade, but I understood it perfectly well. And those beaches were very exposed, I think Mike would agree. And we couldn't guarantee to use them 24 hours a day. And actually, with hindsight, some of the weather blew up in such a way that we might have found ourselves for whole days not being able to use them. The matter of penguins never came up in this discussion. I mean, maybe that Ewan was sort of, you know, hindsight and ha 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 is remembering the penguins. And having been to those beaches since, I might say every time I've been there twice, every time I go there, I say, my God, thank God we didn't land here. And it was just a straight, flat peat bog behind. There was no cover at all for miles. We'd have been absolutely open to attack. It would have been a ghastly place to go. We did have some closer beaches, Mike may remember, but only, really, in the event, which we didn't think was very likely, that they wanted, if Mike may remember this, they wanted an excuse to give in. In other words, there had to be some sort of idea that you landed and they said, right, hands up, we're now going to give in because you're so close. But, I mean, that was, again, fantasy land. San Carlos was the best place, and even 32 years later, I cannot think of a better place to land, actually, than there.
Agree.
Do you have anything to add, Jeremy?
I suppose part and parcel a contributor to the reductive process as to where we might or might land, but I was very happy about San Carlos. There is a story to tell about that, in our brief skirmish in Norway, exercising in March immediately prior to this. Once we conducted the quite simple amphibious operation that Michael has described, Michael and I thought, gosh, this Norwegian area, all these extremely mountainous fjords with water, the very deep water, but also hills, mountains going straight up the water. Of course, the Germans must have known something about this. They must have got a good feel into where to park the Tirpitz and things like that, so far as practicable, where to put ships, so actually it was difficult to get at them in those fjordal surroundings. And we did, with Invincible, with Captain, later Admiral Jeremy Black, we were able to conduct some experiments to see how we could actually station ships in fjordal areas with high mountainous cover in a way that fast jets and actually quite a lot of the current Russian weapon systems simply couldn't get at them. Well, we never imagined what this would imply, but it did mean that given a slightly hilly area, which is all San Carlos was, wouldn't describe it as mountainous, but it did actually, it was clearly, based on our experience, going to channel the kind of fly lines that attacking aircraft would be able to take to get at us within the anchorage. And this proved extremely valuable background, and we set ourselves a task of stationing ships to get maximum protection from the hills around us in a way that proved extremely useful in terms of protection. Getting on to that, the Argentines, we did make some initial mistakes. For instance, the initial stationing of Intrepid was somewhat exposed, and the captain very rapidly explained to us he didn't terribly like where he was, and we moved him around a bit. But we did park ships much closer together than one would ever do in peaceful circumstances, based on the fact that ships swing around their anchors and might bump into each other. As a matter of fact, they never did. But the Argentines only landed two bombs on ships within San Carlos, which neither of which fortunately exploded, and we were able to clear them away in due course. But never did they manage to land a bomb on a ship of a cargo or a merchant capacity. They managed to damage some frigates, alas. We'll be no doubt talking more about that. But the ships were well protected. We were also very careful to station them so that overnight, just in case the Argentines noted where they were parked and should attempt overnight some high-level bombing raids with old Cameras, which they knew they had, Canberra aircraft, we always dispersed ships once it got dark to other places in the anchorage, so the Argentines couldn't deduce from what they'd seen during the day where they might be at night, which was just part and parcel of the games that we were able to play. But the land features that we had just happily and coincidentally learned a bit about from our Norwegian experience proved extremely valuable.
The other thing we'd done in Norway, carrying on from what Jeremy's saying, is we used landing craft a lot to go round into different fields to cut down the amount of time we used on roads. So we, in our minds, long before we got there, was that we'd use landing craft to go round into Salvador water to shorten the distance that the helicopters had to fly to move supplies forward, and that was planned before we got there. So it was natural to us, both the amphibs and ourselves, to use landing craft in that way. There's nothing strange about it. It was just normal, which again is something we'd learned in Norway.
But it would probably be useful to have about half a dozen more landing craft to help doing that, wouldn't it?
I'd like to have had some hovercraft. They would have been fantastic.
Yes.
But we didn't have them. You know, there's no point in wishing for something you haven't got.
Having a much reduced number of support helicopters too was, looking in retrospect, why we were ordered to leave half the Wessex squadron behind at Ascension, when if one had really thought it through, they could have flown out RAF support helicopters, you know, which are not trained to operate from the sea or with Royal Marines, whereas the whole of the 845 was. And, you know, to take any half of them down there, in retrospect, was very foolish. But that was a decision taken by Northwood for reasons, no doubt, which they thought was sensible.
When you think we had, I think it was 11 Sea Kings, we'd lost one in Chile. Night Sea Kings, I think it was 5 Wessex for a brigade of 5,500 men. I mean, it was ludicrous.
And a lot of the gear in the ships could only be lifted up by helicopter. And in fact, unfortunately, some of the gear couldn't even be lifted up by helicopter because they were parked on the upper deck, particularly in Canberra, by crane, and the helicopter strops weren't long enough, so they didn't fly in the triatic wires between the masts and fall out of the sky as a result, and get their strop long enough to go down and lift these bits of cargo off the deck. Little things which became major things as the war went on. If we'd had more time and practiced and thought it through before, they wouldn't have stowed the stuff on the upper deck. But that's hindsight.
And hindsight is always 20/20, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's the sort of problem which we found popping up often, you know, as we went along. And I'm not blaming anybody because it was all helter-skelter. And without the constant training, knowledge, planning, contingency plans, you're bound, I think, to get this sort of result.
I think that the innate can-do attitude of the Royal Navy, and it must be said of the Merchant Navy, was able to get round the problem. There was never a sort of, oh God, we can't do it attitude. It was always, well, we'll think of a way of doing it. It was certainly my observation of it. It was the British seaman at his absolute best, quite frankly.
And the landings. When you have to decide on San Carlos Bay and dealing with all the mess of, before we get to the mess of, well, the almost more complicated task, the amphibious assault is almost less complicated than, I think, than dealing with the offload of the logistics in some respects, because at least it's, you know, it's more straightforward than the men tend to move themselves, whereas the pieces of cargo, as we discussed, don't. What was it, how did you decide which units went where? Were you able to go, this space will particularly suit this unit, or was it more a case of, well, we need to hit these targets, so we're going to have to do the best we can?
Well, you work back from what you're trying to do, and the aim was to secure a beachhead, so you look at the beachhead and how you're going to defend it, and therefore, and then you see, is there a beach near it, and then you allocate people to those beaches. It's really quite simple, actually. There's no particular sort of magic to it. It's a question of working out from a map, no mere photographs, and from knowledge, where you wanted people to end up on that first day, what your beachhead was going to be. And then there were certain beaches, there were only X number of beaches, and then you work out who's going to land on what beach. So it's actually quite simple. From that, You have a surface landing table. We didn't have a helicopter landing table as such. We didn't do any of the assaults by helicopters. All the assaults or all the initial waves were landing craft. Then the helicopter table then was really just taking stuff off when it got daylight. And I allocated the beaches that the way I decided what the beach colour was going to be was what lanyards the guys wore when they went on it. So 40 Commando wore blue lanyards, so they landed on blue beach. So 4-2 Commando wore white lanyards, so they landed on white beach. 4-3 Para had green lanyards, so they landed on green beach. And 4-5 Commando had red lanyards, so they landed on red beach. I thought it'd be an easy way for them to remember what beach they were on. So really that bit is the easy bit. The difficult bit is working out the landing craft schedules so that you make best use of your landing craft assets. And the great advantage of the system, I'm sure Mike will come on for a minute, is it's extremely flexible. So when at the last minute you had to change the landing plan order, it wasn't a problem. You just say, okay, serials 1 to 5 will no longer be serials 1 to 5, they'll be serials 6 to 10, and the other guys will be the other serials. So with the table in front of you, it's really quite easy.
One of the problems that went with as we went on was there were no spare crews, very few spare crews for the helicopters. Jeremy had officers on board who'd flown helicopters, and they went out and supported it. It was quite remarkable. They had their own jobs to do on board, and yet they found time to go and help those ashore. The landing craft had no spare crews either, so we were hoping that they would be able to carry on offloading day and night, and of course they had to have some sleep at some stage. So the landing craft were standing up to it, and they were not needing the amount of maintenance and stuff that the men were. Little things, again, contingency plans, thinking it through long before in peacetime. Julian might like to comment on how long it took to train up troops for some of the amphibious operations in the World War II. Okay, they were on a much greater scale, but the problems are similar.
I think thank you. I mean, one of the people you hear from people, anyone can do an amphibious operation, look at the British Army in Normandy. Yeah, sure. Okay, well, the 3rd Infantry Division, which was the left-hand assault division on a sword beach in Normandy in June 1944, started its amphibious training in April 1943, which is 14 months before. And during that period, they carried out no less than 10 major amphibious exercises, some in the same craft they were going to use in Norway. Well, okay, fine. I mean, you can take a guy off the street who's, you know, sort of dropout, train him to do an amphibious assault if you've got 12 months to do it. But you can't do it if you've got to do it just like that. And this is why it was so important to have people who were trained to do it. And the most important people were not actually the troops themselves, but the staffs who had to work out how to carry out an amphibious operation, how to manage it. And this is the naval staffs as well as the marine staffs. And also how they were going to, as it were, carry out amphibious operations from a fleet of ships that was not designed to do it, who were actually ferries and cruise liners and things like that, who'd never done this in their lives before, and therefore had to be led by the hand, in some cases, by the naval teams who were placed on board, and helped by the staff who had the expertise to be able to extrapolate their knowledge of how to do it if you had a proper ship to if you had to do it from a ship that wasn't designed to do it.
Yeah. Life was also complicated, of course, in terms of the whole process of building up ashore, getting people ashore, by the air attacks that we were undergoing, which started on the day of the landing and with intermissions continued pretty briskly for a period of about 2 weeks. And while attacks were going on, of course, it was very difficult to permit movements, and just simply the process of defending the ships, for instance, it was necessary to stop helicopter movements while attacks were in progress. We got sharper at understanding when these attacks were going to occur. In fact, one reason or another, we nearly always knew once we got the hang of it, but it was very disruptive. And additionally, we were very anxious, or we were instructed not to expose more ships in the anchorage than in San Carlos anchorage than we had to at a time, which led to a very complicated shuttle process of moving ships into the anchorage, unloading them, and then moving them out to holding areas well to the northeast of the Falklands, and convoying them in and out. And it was a very complex process which was managed remarkably well, but it made it extraordinarily huge handicaps in building up the force ashore, which I'm sure Julian will say more about, in an organized way, and then moving forward to actually get about the business of retaking the islands.
I think Jeremy's hit a very important point. The actual assault is very close, obviously, to the heart of the Marines as they land, and they think that through, and they're quite rightly, that is the priority. What we lacked was an understanding of the follow-on logistics and what that would mean. And as Jeremy has just said, we were under pressure not to keep more than immediately important ships in St. Carlos, when I think the logisticians ashore would have liked us to have had the whole lot there so they could pick and choose and say, I want that from that ship and that from that ship, and so on. And the landing craft would go around and pick it up. The other side, which shouldn't have come as a surprise, but it did, was that a ship coming in to St. Carlos would come in overnight for safety. As it arrived, it would then have to unlash all the cargoes down in the hold, and the logisticians would not want what was from the first in the pile, because it hadn't been stowed in that order. They'd want something. So you would have to get the forklift troughs in, moving these pallets with ammunition on, food, fuel, this sort of thing, all around, and till you found the pallet that you wanted, and then you would have to take it out. All this took time. And then before that ship could sail, all this had to be lashed down again, because if he did it at sea and they started sliding around, A, it could have exploded if it was ammunition, and so on. And I hadn't actually registered, but I have to admit, initially, that that was a problem. It just hadn't sort of occurred to me that it was. But it's damned obvious it should have done. And this was a sort of another side to the difficulties of the logistic, unprepared, unthought-through stage. And the land force logisticians can't be blamed. They were there looking for a service. And so they were coming to the shop and asking for this, that, and the other. And we were the shopkeepers and having great difficulty finding it and actually providing it and getting it ashore. So I'm not surprised that a lot of them thought that we were keeping ships out, all this sort of stuff, because quite often it wouldn't be in the ships that were in the anchorage. It would be in a ship that was waiting out in the safety area.
Of course, the other thing, too, picking up on heights, is that you never practice logistics properly on exercises. It's too expensive. Because in order to do it properly, you've got to take all the stuff out of the depots, put it in the ships, then land it, and then break open the ammunition boxes and start issuing it. And if you do that on an exercise, you then have to put it all back again, and it then costs a lot of money to inspect it to make certain it's okay before it goes back into the depot. So you never practice it properly. The second thing, of course, is that the log regiment had only been practiced in our role in Norway or Denmark or wherever, in a NATO scenario, which, as Mike has alluded to earlier, was always arriving during what was known as the time. In other words, there wasn't a war going on. And so when you arrive, loads of friendly Danes would turn up with trucks and help move all your kit, which had been landed by your landing craft onto slipways, and then moved by truck to where you were going to fight. So the log regiment literally had to make it up as they went along, because they'd never done this before, in the way that we were doing it, because they kind of tried it on exercises, which even then, of course, as Mike has alluded to, were always what I call military minuets, with NATO exercises as well, where everyone knew what the score was, and you all knew what the steps were, because you always had to end up looking good at the end of the exercise.
Julian was absolutely right. It became much more marked, not surprisingly, when Fire Brigade came out, because I've spoken to a number of their sergeants and things like that, and officers since, and what is quite clear is that they hadn't really been told of the naval problems on the way down, so they didn't really have an understanding, and they were mentally thinking it was not much, won't be any different from really central front stuff in West Germany. Where you know that in that wood over there is your ammunition, in the other woods your food, and, you know, you get a lorry and you go and collect what you want. And it was all there stockpiled for you. They hadn't been able to think through the problems of having mixed stockpiles in a multitude of ships. And we had, I suppose, it ended up as some 20-odd ships, I would think. I don't know without double-checking on the book. Which had the 3rd Commander Brigade stores and 5 Brigade stores in them, and the naval stores in them, of course, which were equally important, because at one stage we were running out of 4 or 5 ammunition in the ships, and therefore we were looking as if we couldn't do any more gunfire support, and also if the Argentines did break out, we wouldn't be able to fight them at sea. Sounds crazy, but that was the sort of situation you got into if you didn't manage to hold a very tight hand on things and plan well ahead. And we didn't have the staffs organized at sea to do that, like planning ahead, in my view. I know Sandy had a very good man, but he couldn't cope for us as well.
Sorry. And the logistic region, of course, was established or complemented to support a brigade of 3 commandos. It ended up initially supporting a brigade of 3 commandos and 2 parachute battalions. It then ended up having to support 5 brigade as well, who brought in adequate logisticians south. So Ivor Helbert's chap, having been complemented or established to support a brigade of a certain size, suddenly found itself supporting a light division of 2 brigades. So again, a huge strain on them. And they did very well, too.
And it wasn't, strictly speaking, because at that point it was still standard. It was 3 battalions or battalion equivalents per brigade. Yet, then, if I remember correctly, there was about 10, 11 battalions?
Sorry, say again?
There were 10, 11 battalions deployed to the Falklands, weren't there?
No, we had 5 battalion equivalents. The commanders are the same as the battalion.
Yeah.
3 commandos and 2 parachute battalions, plus gunners and all the other things. 5,500 men, and 5 Brigade had 3 battalions, so the total was 8 8 manoeuvre units or battalions.
And if you go by the traditional rules, which I believe are, from what I've always read, are 3 battalions per brigade.
Correct.
It was almost not even a light division, it was 1 battalion short of a full division.
Well, yeah, but without a lot of the other bits.
And, well, I think we've got into San Carlos now, and expanding out from San Carlos, moving the forces forward, how did that work? With especially, there was the change in operational command which took place, and then Jeremy Moore and his staff turning up and all these things. What was it like managing the choreography of the breakout and also having to deal with, well, some of the political missions which were sent down to you, for example, the Goose Green operation?
Right. The main objective was always to get onto the high ground overlooking Stanley, Mount Kent. Because obviously Stanley was the objective. And that was what we were working towards from the very first. So for example, on the first night, I put forward my recce troop some 40 kilometers ahead of me onto the high ground overlooking the route we'd used. And then we started to try and get recce up onto Mount Kent with the idea that we'd fly the brigade forward using the Chinooks in Atlantic Conveyor. I'll come back to that in a minute. At the same time, I decided we would raid Goose Green because I'd been told in a direction from Jeremy Moore to attack the enemy that was nearest to me in order to make their life difficult. And the nearest people were actually Goose Green some 14 miles away. And I decided to do a raid. I didn't want to get tied up with holding the place. And I ordered 2 paras to prepare to do a raid. And eventually, to cut a long story short, it became far too much of a drain on our resources to do a raid because we were trying at the same time to get people up onto Mount Kent. And night after night, with bad weather, we couldn't move our recce from the SAS onto Mount Kent. And eventually, following the sinking of Atlantic Conveyor, when I was making plans to move forward, traps by helicopter, a chap stuck his head round the storm of a tent and said Atlantic Conveyor has been sunk and taken all the Chinook with her. It wasn't quite true, there was one survived away on a trip. So that was sort of tear it up and start all over again day. I cancelled the Goose Green raid, and I was then summoned to the SATCOM by the chief, who said, you are to get on and why did you cancel the Goose Green operation? I told him, and he said, well, you'll put it on again, and you'll start breaking out. So I gave orders that night to the 2 para to go on and take Goose Green, and for 4-5 commander and 3 para to start moving out of the beachhead. So that very night, the movement out of the beachhead started. Goose Green is an interesting one because it was really a political decision, quite rightly actually, that we needed a victory. We'd been losing a lot of ships, a lot of men, and had achieved, to the ordinary person on the ground or to anyone else actually, really nothing. So we needed a success. And that's life, you have to get on with it. And so that's what happened. That's the genesis of Goose Green. Unfortunately, I didn't give it enough attention. I made 3 mistakes. One was I didn't go and command myself. Secondly, I should have taken another commando down. And thirdly, I should have acquiesced with H. Jones's request that I send part of my light armor down. I thought that they would get bogged down on the way down and be left stranded there as targets for the enemy air. And I took counsel of my fears and didn't send them, and that was a mistake. So that was the reason why the Goose Green operation took so long, because it was under-supported. Further reasons were that their ammunition that was being sent down to them was destroyed when the Argentines bombed our BMA, which didn't help either, and so they ran out of ammunition. The move round on foot by the two commandos went well and was very successful. So that was the genesis of the breakup. We were successful at Goose Green, thanks to the two para who fought brilliantly well, and we learned a hell of a lot of lessons from it. And one of the lessons was, don't fight by daylight here if you can possibly avoid it, because the rope and rolling country plays into the hands of the enemy who have better long-range machine guns than we do. And so that's really the genesis of the breakout. I don't know if you want to come back to me on any of those points that I made.
I'll let Michael and Jeremy carry on, then I'll come back to points.
I would just like to say that while I understand Admiral Fieldhouse's point of view that we were losing ships and therefore they wanted the landing force to break out, this was not part of the plan, and this is not what Jeremy Moore had ordered Julian to do. And at that stage, technically, the amphibious operation is under my command. And I personally believe it was a bad decision. I have a feeling, I don't know what the situation was back in the UK, but the Chief of Defence Staff or Admiral Fieldhouse or something could well have stood up and said, look, hang on. Yes, we're losing ships, but this is the naval phase. In a minute, we will do that. But we are very short of helicopters. We are very short of movement assets. Let's get them properly established and so on. the risk to me, sitting back in St. Carlos while the attack on Darwin and Goose Green was going on, was, oh my God, are we going to lose a helicopter? Are we going to lose more Sea Harriers or anything like that? And are we going to screw up our chances of supporting Julian when he's 60 miles further away down near Mount Kett, attacking the Fort Stanley's defences, which is actually the only real problem we've got? Can we not contain Darwin Goose Green? But politics is politics, I suppose, and I don't think Northwood, they certainly didn't consult me and ask me what my views were, and I think if they had, I can't say that I would have been as clear about it as I am now, but I hope I would have been. Because I remember feeling that at the time, and it was what triggered me to go ashore and find Julian and to say, look, I think the command structure is a mess. I'm going straight out to collect Jeremy Moore. And Jeremy Larkin and I sailed and went out and picked up Jeremy Moore, and I briefed him, and he was not happy with what was going on either when he was told about this. So I think it probably came about through rather casual conversation, saying, my gosh, they're sitting there tight. Shouldn't they be breaking out? Well, the reason we couldn't break out was the lack of assets. It all took time to get their stores forward and get them forward and get the guns forward and all the rest of it. And this was not obviously clear to Northwood, who no longer had Jeremy Moore and Royal Marines there advising him, and I just wonder if that was part of the reason.
There was certainly a lack of clarity, wasn't there? And I really defer to Julian and Michael, who were having to cope with this, but there was a lack of clarity in how the command arrangements were organized from Northwood. Northwood took what they supposed was a very firm hand in defining what the task of a force and task group organization was as things progressed. But I think one of the messier elements was that the well-tried system whereby in an amphibious operation the maritime commander retains command of the whole inshore operation to a certain stage, and then there is a very clear stage of handover once the beachhead is firmly secure and the landing force is firm ashore. I don't think that was understood by Northwood, and that was a pity, because a great deal of anguish and blood was shed from Gallipoli onwards through World War II, establishing that extremely firm and essential principle. I don't know whether Michael and Julian have a further comment on that.
Well, of course, it was laid down. Jerry, you're absolutely right. It was laid down quite clearly in Allied Tactical Publication number 8, which was the NATO publication, what the setup should be. Why they didn't follow it, I don't know. The other thing, I think, which was a mistake, was not having an in-theater commander down south, in overall command of all three task groups. And they could have done it. I mean, at the Derek Raffel would have been the ideal chap to do it. And indeed, in those days, there were two DLGs in the task force, who I think I'm right in saying, Jeremy, were fitted for flag. So you could have put a flag officer in one of the DLGs without him having to, as it were, you know, step on the toes of Sandy Woodward in Hermes and take up his command position. And he would have been able to rove in that DLG. By that I mean sort of spend time out with the carriers, come in and see what the problem was at the beachhead, and then draw together the threads of the whole operation and being responsible for dealing with Northwood and saying, look, chaps, this is the way it's going, and as it were, being an advocate on our behalf down on the ground. I don't know, Mike may have a view on this.
I think that's absolutely right. It would have made a huge difference because there was clearly a misunderstanding as to who was in command of what. And the moment the landing force had landed on the ground, I suspect Northwood was saying, well, he's a separate task group commander, which he was originally by the command structure, and so we'll deal direct with him. They didn't understand the problems of an amphibious landing lasting a week, 10 days, until the landing force commander, it's not a naval decision, the landing force commander decides he is ready to go it alone, i.e. he doesn't need the Navy's help anymore. He doesn't need the Navy's help with landing craft and helicopters. And the only thing then is that I transfer the helicopters or landing craft to him if he does need them, but he doesn't need the ships, he's offloaded and everything. So technically it goes on until he has all the stores he needs. And that wasn't understood. So I'm afraid it's inevitable if you set up an operation in 5 days' notice and off you go.
But even taking up Mike's point, even if landing craft had been passed to my command, the LPDs would have to have stayed there because we couldn't just have the LCUs and the LCVPs sitting on a beach. They had to be refueled, maintained, go back for maintenance, etc., etc. So the LPDs would have to stay there. So who would have commanded them? I mean, the way it worked actually was that they stayed under your command, as I understand it, right throughout, quite rightly, because they were your assets.
Yeah.
It seemed to me, I have to say, in my own studies, I agreed very much with the point that there should have been Derek Raffel down there in one of the DLGs. Those destroyers, the interesting thing in them story is that actually that was one of the roles envisaged for them when they were first designed, because the Royal Navy was no longer going to have cruisers.
No.
So these cruiser destroyers, as they're originally called, but eventually came out as just the county destroyers, which were slightly bigger and had the facilities of all them. It was what they were designed for. It was one of their missions was this. There would be a task force commander, and so that they could go between amphibious, carrier, and all the other operations, and could do it. And that was one of their purposes.
I think Michael and I can speak with some authority on that. Michael, I know, was the XO of one of the Batch 2 DLGs, Norfolk. I was XO of Glamorgan and had an extraordinary experience. Of course, my captain, when I was rather young, my captain got unwell and I was given command of her for a rather interesting period where I happened to have a rehearsal as flag captain for the then very young Rear Admiral John Fieldhouse. And I can attest that Glamorgan was very well fitted as a flagship, and I think Antrim, the other Batch 2 DLG down there, was also so fitted. So those ships were available. Indeed, Sandy Woodward, at the beginning of the operation, was embarked in Glamorgan and had used her in that capacity. He had to move for Hermes, and it's actually quite complicated, and I think it's something I would hesitate to go into in this podcast, but I think Admiral Woodward was quite, there were real misunderstandings, which I think belong outside this, but he was inhibited because I think that the situation he found in Hermes made it very difficult for him to get out of Hermes, and there's no doubt about it, the senior officer down there, if there is going to be someone so designated, needs to get around. He really couldn't because he felt unable, for reasons which I now understand better than I could possibly do at the time. It really was not appropriate for him to leave Hermes because of quite severe differences in the way operations should be conducted between himself and the captain of Hermes, who would have been in control of the air assets in his absence. And whatever may have been the strengths and weaknesses of Admiral Woodward's command arrangements, he calculated the use of the carriers to a nicety in terms of ensuring that they kept out of harm's way, because had we lost or one of them been severely damaged, we would have been in extreme difficulty. And to a mathematical nicety, he kept them just where he could provide the best support he possibly could, whilst ensuring their safety from the Exocet threat, which was serious, and it was very difficult. And yes, I think it probably would have been a good idea or wise to have had Admiral Reffel, who was supremely prepared for that by that time, in another ship, but it didn't happen. And I think all you can say about it is that actually command and control, command arrangements in operations at the best of time were extremely difficult to maintain and to get right. They were very difficult down south. The fact of the matter is that being mature and experienced people in these things, we did get it right, and despite all the difficulties, it did come out right, and we did win. And I don't think the command difficulties are any more extreme, particularly in view of the extremely short notice of the operation as a whole, which we discussed at length. It worked out remarkably well in the circumstances, and if you go back in the history of World War II and the naval operations in World War I, you'd see we really had learned a thing or two and managed despite all sorts of difficulties.
I think you might read into that with Jeremy saying that Admiral Woodward could have commanded the amphibious side as well as the carrier side. Personally, I think he had quite enough on his own plate, looking after the carriers, the tug repair logistics area, looking after the logistics coming in and out of St. Carlos, which, as far as I was concerned, he did extremely well. And I'm perfectly happy with the way all that went. So I think it needed two commanders concentrating entirely on two very, very different tasks. And Admiral Reffel had at least had my job before me. He'd also commanded an aircraft carrier and things like that. So he got a lot of surface war experience, and he would have been ideal, to my mind, to be a shuttle and to stand back, listen to Sandy, listen to me, go ashore, talk to Julian, listen to him, merge all the worries and concerns together, and by resolve problems down there, but report back on a fairly frequent basis as the one person who reported back to Northwood. As it was, we had Admiral Woodward reporting back, I was reporting back, and I imagine Julian, obviously he was being called by Admiral Fieldhouse to report back, and certainly when Jeremy Moore came down, he provided a third who was reporting back as well. And I think Northwood must have been getting some quite confused stories coming out or misunderstandings as to what was going on, because there is no way that, say Jeremy Moore and Admiral Woodward would necessarily see the situation in the same way. Say they would report with an emphasis on different aspects, whereas one man might have been able to coordinate it and draw the priorities out.
I actually agree. I mean, I sent back to Citra because I was under direct command of the task force command. I mean, actually, in theory, on the tender, before we got there, Jeremy Moore was made the CTG over my head, but he was in a ship that had no communication, so I de facto was the landing force commander. So I sent a daily Citra back. So the Northwood was actually getting three Citras. that. One from me, one from Mike, and one from Sandy. So some guy in North is sitting in a bunker 8,000 miles away, 2,000 miles further away from we were than Japan is, trying to juggle three different citrus. You know, what's this guy talking about? Why is he saying this? Why is he saying that? Absolute nonsense. It needed somebody to draw the threads together to send back a consolidated citra saying this is happening, and give the task force commander a clear picture of what the hell was happening on the ground and at sea. Well, of course.
There was a fourth commander who was a submarine, of course, and that must have been an interesting situation in Northwood to try and coordinate that, so that they were giving the best support they could to the forces at sea, rather. Easily forgotten what they were up to.
And they were up to a lot. If we move on, so broken out and we've got through this sort of issue, the movements forward, the coordinating, the naval assets, we of course... The issue always comes up once you're starting amphibious operations and you're looking at Falklands War is the Galahad incident and all the things around that and having to move LSLs to Teal Inlet that and all the various, well, basically the supplies and logistics that went with the amphibious with the movement forward. How was conducting that as part of the operation? What was it like? What were the problems and possible and solutions you had to improvise?
I was very happy with the plan that Julian and I agreed, which was to use the North Coast, because getting around from San Carlos and into San Salvador to Teal Inlet, an LSL could do that in a matter of hours. He could do it during a night. He could get in there with safety. And we left landing craft there, and so the offload could go ahead, and it could go further up towards Kent, again, largely by landing craft, as Julian has already described. And that was good. Going around the south coast, wherever you went, meant a very long tour. And it would take more than the night was long to get an LSL around there. So I had not been enthusiastic, and I'd explained that early on. And I thought the whole thing was sort of going quietly, as far as the LSLs were concerned. You've got to remember from about the 26th of May, the weather clamped. A lot of people said we'd got air superiority. We hadn't. We had just, the cloud had given us effectively air superiority in San Carlos because the aircraft couldn't land. Couldn't come down with hills around safely and attack us if they could even find us. Single seat aircraft, not easy navigating around like that. So a lot of people misled, I think, in their thinking. So when the five brigade were sent to the south coast, what we originally planned to do was to do it by LPD, Intrepid taking the Scots Guards, Fearless coming in the second night, taking the Welsh Guards, using the same landing craft. But that got cocked up because the landing craft were hijacked for a different reason and we weren't told. So we sat off there and we had taken two landing craft with us and we were going to take all four back, the first ones back, and leave the two ashore. The only LSL that we were going to have to send round was Sir, I can't remember the name now, wasn't Sir Percival, it was
Sir Tristram.
Sir Tristram, thank you, with Robin Green. And we had to use an LSL because she was taking four rapiers, she was taking a lot of ammunition, she was taking a lot of fuel, and she was taking a field ambulance team who wouldn't have been able to come with Fearless and allow us to land the Scots Guards and the Welsh Guards, you see. So when the night came, Sir Tristram unfortunately, was not properly loaded. The rapiers could not be got down from the hilltops because they were in cloud. The field ambulance team was not ready to embark, and so she was full of ammunition and stores. So Colonel Baxter, Colonel General Moore's Colonel AQ, who had been extremely helpful and was well aware of the problems, knew exactly how I would feel about it. But the cloud base was still low, and when he asked me, almost on his bended knee, to help him out, the only ship I had was the Galahad, who was empty, just come back from Teal Inlet. So we got the rapier onto that, we got the field ambulance into her, and we got more stores and more ammunition and more fuel. And because it was a 16-hour trip around, she was sailed from St. Carlos in clamped weather. I couldn't get a weather report from anybody in the Fitzroy area. Probably they were keeping radio silence and didn't wish to break silence and let the enemy know they were there. But so when she went round, actually the weather had broken, and although in the St. Carlos Inlet it was further downwind and was taking longer to clear. But it was quite clear to me that morning that the situation was extremely unpleasant. What I didn't know was that the Tristram was staying there because she had not been fully offloaded. So Tristram was tucked in under a cliff where I expected the Galahad to go, but the Galahad had to anchor further out. So generally speaking, it was one thing after another, helter-skelter, and out at sea, I was getting reports from Sandy Woodward about four or five ammunition for the ships running out and what we were going to do if we didn't finish it all quickly. I was getting reports from General Moore of frostbite and stuff on the troops, getting soaking wet and freezing cold, and he was desperate to get on with the battle. So I'm afraid I agreed to it, and I'm glad I think I was right to do so, because it did mean that actually the majority of the people and all the ammunition and the rapiers and the field ambulance and everybody were got ashore. The tragedy was the Welsh Guards waiting for his orders from his commanding officer, where they had no communications between the two of them, so he stayed on board against the advice of two of my staff officers and two of General Moore's staff officers. But I'm afraid you can't account for these sort of things. We didn't know they had a major communications problem in Fire Brigade. We didn't know that their landing, their Land Rovers and communications Land Rovers were still back in Darwin. We had thought they were all up with Fire Brigade.
I would like to reinforce what Michael has said. It was an extremely difficult period. It was complicated, and I think he's being rather polite about some things that went awry, which were quite beyond his control. And the fact of the matter was, I defer to Julian, but 5 Infantry Brigade headquarters had deployed itself forward in a premature manner. I know they're trying to get on with it, but they moved, they deployed forward with quite inadequate preparation, inadequate communications, and certainly not keeping anyone else properly informed of what the situation was. And having got themselves in that position, they then did a number of fairly high-handed things, not least of which was to hijack a number of landing craft, which in itself necessitated the deployment of half the Welsh Guards, because only half could be landed from Fellis. The other half had to be brought back because they had prevented the landing craft from being at the appointed rendezvous. All very hazardous for many people concerned, including the well-being of Fellis, because she had to stay forward, just keeping clear of a very dangerous arc of intelligence of shore-based Exocet, which we did manage to remain clear of, perhaps more by luck than good judgment, and a very late return to San Carlos of this key ship in the whole command arrangement. But Michael had no alternative but to embark the remainder of the Welsh Guard to Galahad with the tragic outcome that occurred. But the whole dysfunctionality of the command arrangements at the Fox Bay, at the Bluff Cove Fitzroy end, contributed to the lack of activity in getting both Sir Tristram and Sir Galahad unloaded in a timely manner. It was not a good piece of command organization, which was actually beyond intended control of Jeremy Moore as the divisional commander. Yeah. Is that fair, Julian?
I absolutely agree with what Jeremy said. The move forward was so sudden because they didn't tell us. We nearly shelled it. And that would have ended up as a mega blue-on-blue. And we would have killed a lot of other people. But luckily, we found out at the last minute that this move forward had taken place. But this is a very good example of a brigade that was totally unused to operating in a joint environment. Mike may have already said this, in which case I apologise, but what they didn't realise is you couldn't just unilaterally do things without telling other people what you were doing. And one of the reasons, of course, one of their helicopters was shot down because they had failed to tell people what they were doing. And three people paid for it with their lives. We were very lucky that hundreds more, and I mean hundreds more, were not killed because of the irresponsible attitude displayed by that headquarters.
As a direct consequence of this, one of my own landing craft, LCU Foxtrot 4, was improperly deployed in moving material and people up and down Truswell Sound, and was bounced in broad daylight in the raid following that on Sir Galahad and Sir Tristram. Bless you. Which caused the loss of six people, very tragically and unnecessarily in one landing craft, as just another example of the extremely unsatisfactory chaos created by this ill-planned move forward, and the extremely unsatisfactory command direction that occurred for a critical few days before control was re-established. Alexander, I've got to make my apologies because actually unscheduled. I'm not somewhere in the UK. I'm in Riyadh, and quite soon I've got to catch an aeroplane back to the UK. I think I've probably made my principal contribution. I don't know whether any other particular questions for me, but I think I will have to drop off rather shortly.
There's only one question which really I'll ask you now, and then I'll ask the others in a bit because I've got one more question for them before then. Which is...
In other words, in half an hour.
Okay. The question is this. Are there any lessons you learnt in the war, during the Falklands War, that you wish you'd known before you'd done it, before you began the war, and that you think that must be learnt by future officers who find themselves in similar positions?
For me, that's a fastball. I think, all things considered, one does prepare for war, knowing that one is going to be, whatever, however careful the preparations, one is going to be presented with something that is totally unexpected. And that was the case here. I think that we had, as a nation, because of pressure on defence, we'd prepared ourselves to become a specialist navy to fight anti-submarine warfare alongside the Americans in the North Atlantic. And we retained that priority through the deployment, the structure of, in particular, the submarine force and the surface escort force and towed arrays and the way we configured our now small aircraft carriers, which were designed principally for anti-submarine warfare with just a nod towards amphibious possibilities. We had become a specialist open ocean anti-submarine warfare navy. We were totally unprepared to fight this kind of war 8,000 miles from home, albeit with ascension as an intermediate stopping point, as it were, in enclosed waters, where, apart from the hills, not many of our radars were capable of seeking aircraft across land features. They couldn't see aircraft across land at all. There were some exceptions. Moreover, we had got rid of a long-range airborne early warning, which was another critical deficiency. Well, that's what comes, I'm afraid, of specialization in a complex world. And I can only say that things have changed for the worse overall. There was a period after the Falklands, and I was fortunate to be in the Ministry of Defence to help the process, where we set about learning the lessons. And for a limited period, there was a boost in re-preparing ourselves for less specialised operations. And one of the things that Admiral Fieldhouse said, that we must never have escorts again which don't have a gun, for instance. And we spent quite a lot of energy successfully in the period following the Falklands in restoring our ability to conduct a two-company group lift. Do I mean two-company group lift, Doolin, or one? It was a company group lift, wasn't it? And to that end, we were able to replace Fearless Intrepid with two specialist ships which are alive and well today, the Albion and Bulwark, the Albion and Bulwark. But I think some of the principles, including the helicopter lift required to achieve that objective, a fully equipped company group, I suspect has even now withered. Is that correct, Julian?
I think it's now a company group. The original lift was a commando group, but it's now down, I think, to a company group lift.
Well, that was actually the objective. I think it was a two-company group lift that we tried to achieve, and I think it's been reduced to one.
Yeah.
I think probably that's the best I've got to offer in terms of what we should have known beforehand, which is really reiterating what, in slightly different terms, Michael said at the outset. And for various reasons, we've become really a specialist anti-submarine warfare navy for the North Atlantic, capable of dealing with aircraft attacks to a degree conducted by the Soviets in brigade style, but with open water, so we could see them coming in plenty of time and with good intelligence. And the Russians could never get round the North Cape without it being pretty obvious they were coming. On the plus side, though, once you do get yourself into an inshore situation, maybe you can't see it very well, but the enemy can't either. And the Argentine, very gallant Argentine aircraft who tried to bomb us out of San Carlos water, once they got within visual of the forces within San Carlos, they had 15 seconds actually to decide what to do and actually drop their weapon, which was extremely challenging, particularly with the amount of stuff however inaccurately directed we were able to throw up at them. So it wasn't much fun for them either. And indeed, in the scale of things, they ran out of aircraft before we ran out of ships. And not only that, it was only the warships that got bashed about, which is, after all, is what they're for. And apart from the tragedy of the Atlantic Conveyor and Sir Tristram and Sir Galahad, all outside San Carlos, the Argentines didn't lay a finger on the merchant shipping that counted, or the support shipping. I think that's probably, and Michael and Julian will wish to pick that up, but I'm afraid I will have to move on now.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking part.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I hope the flight home is nice and relaxing and the food's actually good.
We've been on the wagon for a week, so a glass of something would be welcome. Anyway, thank you all so much for letting me participate. And good night.
Jeremy, thank you.
Good to see you.
Thanks so much. Good night, Michael.
Thank you.
Bye. I think the other point, which is, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
The other point, which I think is important as a sort of lessons learned, is a more, perhaps not philosophical, but sort of, okay, call it philosophical point, is what I call attitude. And I sense in today's defense this sort of idea that they've always been able to predict what's going to happen in the future. This is why they've designed the forces this way, slightly. I mean, it's usually what can we afford, and therefore what can we do? Secondly, that they don't believe in the unexpected and takes them by surprise, and there's this sort of how should I put it, modern idea that everything can be predicted. Well, of course, it bloody well can't, because there are several things about it which people seem to forget, is that the enemy thinks too, and the enemy will work out how to bugger your day by looking at what you can do and then doing something that he hopes you won't be able to do if he's got his sense. And in fact, this modern terminology, asymmetric warfare, which gets trotted out at every possible opportunity as if it was something new, is not. You always fight asymmetrically. There's nothing to do with guerrillas fighting or anything. You fight in a way that you hope the enemy can't match you. That's asymmetric. If you fight symmetrically, you're an idiot, because actually you're playing into the enemy's hands. You always, if you possibly can, do something that isn't going to be what he expects, and so you play to his weaknesses and play to your own strengths. And I don't think people realize that either, or they've hoisted it in. And I turn to the great philosopher Hegel, who said, quote, "What experience and history teaches us is this, that people and governments never have learned anything from history or acted on principles deduced from it." And I'm afraid we're seeing this again in defense. We're seeing it again. You know, we've been round this boy before many times, and you get these people, what I call sort of hubristic guys who reckon that they can see the future. If they can see the future, why aren't they earning their money on a racetrack, betting on horses? And think that they can see the future instead of really working out that what we need is an armed forces that is able to meet all the unexpected things that are going to hit us. Because as Gwythian Prince said to me the other day when I met him, they think that your defense is dictated by financial and economic terms. It isn't. Your defense is dictated to you by the enemy, what he's going to do to you. And if you haven't worked out what he's going to do, or worked out what he might do in every possibility, then you're going to get caught very badly unprepared.
It's very true. Michael?
I completely agree. I remember at the time being really rather horrified. I had, in a frigate, I'd sailed around the world. I'd called in at magnificent overseas territories now, like Pitcairn, with a population of some 50, totally dependent on us. No one seemed to accept that a 200-mile radius around the islands was all economic zone for which we're responsible. Could there be fuel? Certainly fish. What about minerals? No, you just don't know. And how are we ever going to hoist in the fact that we have a responsibility to these people? Do we just turn our backs on them? And the only service that can provide this defence and the deterrence, which is better than the defence, is the Royal Navy, I'm afraid. You can go and garrison Pitcairn with, you know, 100 soldiers, but there's no airfield there, so who is going to feed them? The Navy. Who is going to supply them? The Navy. So why attempt to do it? Just let the Navy get on with it. And somewhere along the line, we have completely lost this. And on that same round-the-world cruise, and on many others, going to places like New Zealand and Australia and Canada, you are constantly asked, why have you dumped us? Why have you gone wholly into Europe? We've supported you in two world wars. Now, come on. You know, do you expect us to support you again? I know we've got cousins and brothers and uncles and aunts related, but you're stretching the point. And I totally agree with them. I find it appalling. And we tried to get out of the empire. Fine. Walking out on India, we did it too early, but nevertheless, it was done. But India is not a Commonwealth country like Australia or New Zealand, which was largely colonized by British descendants. And even India, I think, you know, was not actually all that pleased that we walked out on them. There will be those who were, but in many respects they would like to have had the continuity longer. I just felt that we went through a very, very bad stage, and it became a habit, and it became sort of a political attitude. It's all politics. It's, you know, the service can go on bleating like mad and demanding more ships and demanding more this, that, and the other. But until they take a decision, like as Julian has said, and looked at the threat and looked at their responsibilities and accepted their responsibilities, the services will be caught out every time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that's... Is there anything you two, either you of you would wish to add, or
no,
shall we call it a wrap?
Read the books.
Read the books. Well, why don't you do a quick plug of those, actually? Julian, start off, because you've got quite a few books. Give a quick plug of your books. What are their titles?
Read the book. I'm just saying that, because we can go into more detail. But I think we've made the points, the broader points.
Yes, you have. I've got quite a few of them looking at me right now.
I'm writing a book on Gallipoli right now, actually. And it's quite interesting to see how unprepared we were for an amphibious operation in 1915. Mm. Totally unprepared.
And one of the interesting things with that is that that comes after Fisher had basically launched an entire building plan, which was designed on giving us amphibious capability to go into the Baltic and go around there. Suddenly we launch at the other end, at the other end of the Mediterranean. We're sort of going, we have nothing.
What Fisher failed to do, and I know he did a great deal, we're going right outside the Falklands here, he couldn't remember it because he hadn't said it. But if he'd had Ramsay, or if he could see into the future, he would find a chap called Ramsay saying that amphibious operation must work, work out what you want to do ashore. And no one had worked out what they wanted to do ashore in the Baltic, because there was no point in going to the Baltic and landing there, because we were going to go straight into the teeth of the Prussian army or the German army. So landing in the Baltic was just a complete waste of rations. And I know he built these beetles, which he then refused to allow to go to Gallipoli until the Suga landings in August. But even so, even if he had, they'd still cocked it up, because they hadn't got any of the things that we now have, like proper reconnaissance and all the things, and we can't go into the start to. But it was a low point, actually, in the art of amphibiosity, Gallipoli. And I think that's probably enough for me.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Well done.